Geographically, Kyoto is a city not unlike Los Angeles. Although in Los Angeles, the hills go more or less straight on the north side of the city, Kyoto is enclosed by hills west, north, and east, and is open to the south. But you've got the same sort of situation of a great flat city with hills, and of course the same conditions are developing that develop in Los Angeles. There's a considerable smog problem building up. But for a long, long time, Kyoto has had the situation that the desirable land for residence is in the hills, just as here. It's interesting that Kyoto is one of the great ancient cities of the world that is also like an American city in the respect that it's laid out on a gridiron pattern. And I think it's the only great ancient city that's planned in this way. But as I said, the desirable land is in the hills. If you're wealthy, the hills are full of absolutely gorgeous villas and parks. And they have also the advantage, they're full of water springs. And you can pipe in water to your garden and have running water in your stone hollowed out bowl near your tea house. And in ancient times, of course, it was all brought in by bamboo tubes. But the curious thing is that the best land in town is occupied by Buddhist temples. And the really gorgeous sites are Zen temples. How come? Because those hills from most ancient times were occupied by extremely redoubtable brigands who later became, of course, ladies and gentlemen, daimyo, nobles, and their samurai retainers. But those Buddhist monks sure got away with it. I said yesterday that they live in a sort of state of what I would call luxurious asceticism. Zen is a simplified life, really. No property, but you own yourself. Therefore, no responsibility for it in the way of financial worry. The style of life, the way a temple is furnished, is completely uncluttered. The rooms of a temple are mostly empty. They're just spaces, but gorgeous spaces. And so, because as I pointed out, space is the most valuable thing in Japan, space is reverenced. I want to talk a bit about space. Because in this country, where we have so much space, we don't appreciate it. And we think that space is equivalent to nothing. It's something simply that isn't there. We think of space as a blank. And in a crowded situation, you see, people really notice space. But it's interesting, too, that China is a country where there's lots of space. But it was the Chinese, I think, above all, who first taught man to appreciate space. And we're living in a space age, and it's strange that our culture is the kind of forerunner in space navigation and space exploration, and yet at the same time, we don't really understand space at all. And one of the great contributions of Zen to the Western world is understanding of space. So the best space in town, as I said, is occupied by these Zen temples, taken away from the brigands, who somehow let these monks come in, because the monks put one over on the brigands. and got the space. Now, how did they do it? You know, of course, that in the Kamakura epoch, Zen had an enormous influence on the samurai warrior caste, that is to say, the kshatriya of Japan. This was a time in which Japan was torn by internal strife. There was constant war between the various feudal lords and vying with each other to obtain control of the imperial power. And they went to study Zen as soldiers in order to learn fearlessness. And that was the point where the Zen monks outphased the samurai, because they prided themselves on their manly and warrior-like qualities, but they couldn't scare the Zen monks, because the Zen monks just were not fazed, were not stopped by the idea of death. Excuse me if I've told some of you this story before, but it's pertinent. There was once a young man who applied to a fencing master to be his student. And the master looked at him and said, who did you study with before? He said, I've never studied fencing before. The master looked at him in a funny way and said, no, surely, come now. You have studied with someone. He said, no, sir, I never have studied. Well, the master said, look, I'm an experienced teacher, you know, and I can tell at once by looking at a person whether he has studied fencing or not. And I know you have. And the young man shook his head and he said, sir, I assure you, I've never studied fencing at all with anybody. Well, said the master, there must be something peculiar about you. What do you suppose it could be? Well, the young man said, when I was a boy, I was very worried about dying. So I thought a great deal about death. And then I came to the realization that there's nothing in death to be afraid of. Oh, said the master, that explains it. R.H. Blythe told us that the initial part of Zen training, the beginning of Zen, has as a matter of fact the purpose of overcoming the fear of death. In other words, what I described to you as the Hinayana stage of Zen study, where you go down here, withdraw consciousness, as it were, back to its source, this is the initial stage. And so as you go down, you see, you go down into that dimension of your own being where you go deeper than your own individuality. And you realize that you belong down here, really. That's where you truly exist. And what you feel as your individuality is something temporal, like the leaves of a deciduous tree. In the season of the fall, they dry up and drop off. And so the Japanese, in their poetry, always liken death to the fall and winter season. And there's a feeling about a human life that it's simply harmonious with the seasons of the year. This goes through all Japanese poetry and aesthetics. And therefore, old people are looked upon as those who are in the winter of life, or the fall of life. And just as the maple trees in Japan become absolutely gorgeous in the fall, so there is a respect for age. Our old people in Japan look much better than our old people because they're not fighting with age, they're cooperating with it. It is an honorable thing to be old. At least it used to be true. And as I said, for women, age means respect and authority. And this feeling of the harmoniousness of human life with the life of nature makes aging and death less problematic for people with that sort of psychology. They see, in other words, they see old age not as the deterioration of a living being, just as they don't see the fall and winter as a deterioration of time. They see it as the proper rhythm of time. I suppose for us who live here in a more or less seasonless world, this may be a difficult correspondence to work out. We don't feel the seasons in the same way. And also, do you remember, I pointed out yesterday, the idea that the great Zen master Dogen put in his book, The Shobo Genzo. Actually, he got this idea from a Chinese student of Kumarajiva, lived about 400 AD, that events in time are eternal. That is to say, each event stays in its own place. The burning wood does not become ashes. There is first wood, and then there is ashes. So he says, the spring does not become the summer. There is spring, then there is summer, then there is fall, then there is winter. It's a curious idea that the sun in its rotation doesn't move. This is a sort of paradoxical saying. The river doesn't flow. It's in a way, it's like Heraclitus. You never step into the same river twice. There's a very close parallel between all the thinking of Heraclitus and Taoist philosophy. The yang and the yin. If you really want to go, Heraclitus is the most original thinker in Western thought. And Philip Wheelwright, in the last few years, published an excellent translation of what remains of the fragments of Heraclitus' philosophy. If the West had founded itself on Heraclitus rather than Aristotle, we'd have been a lot better off. Most ingenious man. Well, anyway, this feeling of death as a completely natural event, which only, as it were, is the dropping of the leaves, and the root underneath is always there. Now, what is difficult, I suppose, to appreciate about this is that you say, well, I'm not aware of the root. It doesn't enter into my ordinary life at all. I'm only on top. How do I get down? Well, of course, the top, in a certain sense, is the top, and it can't get down and be the bottom. So this is the same question that people raise when they say, how do I get rid of my egocentricity? Well, obviously, with egocentricity, you can't get rid of egocentricity. As the master Bunke said, you can't wash off blood with blood. And trying to realize your Buddha nature by some sort of egocentric effort is like trying to wash off blood with blood. Bunke, in his teaching, very much emphasized the way in which you have this root in you by such things as this. He would say, when you hear a bell ringing, you don't have to think about it. You know at once that it's a bell. When you hear the crow cawing, you don't, by any effort or cleverness of your conscious will, know that it's a crow. Your mind does that for you. And so once, when he was being heckled by a Nichiren priest, I explained those Nichirens are very fanatical. The Nichiren priest was standing on the fringe of a crowd listening to Bunke, and he said, I don't understand a single word you're saying. And Bunke said, will you come closer and I'll explain it to you. And so this priest walked into the crowd. And Bunke said, come on, come closer. And he came closer. Come closer still. And he came closer. Please, closer still. Until he was right next to Bunke. Bunke said, how well you understand me. He emphasized, in other words, that we have what he called husho, the unborn mind in us, and this is the unborn mind. That means the level of mind that doesn't arise, that is to say, be born, into individuality. We all have that original endowment, and it is because of that that we, when you say good morning, somebody says good morning, and that's the unborn mind. You don't think to do this. It's the unborn mind through which your eyes are blue or brown, by reason of which you see and breathe. And breathing is important in the practice of meditation, because it is the faculty in us which is simultaneously voluntary and involuntary. You can feel that I am breathing, and equally you can feel it breathes me. So it is a sort of bridge between the voluntary world and the involuntary world, where they are one. So, to acquire the sense that your unconscious life, which isn't unconscious in the sense that it lacks consciousness, it is the root of consciousness, it is that out of which consciousness comes. And just as the leaves come every year on the tree, so consciousness perpetually comes and goes out of the, shall we say, supraconscious base. You don't need, in order to appreciate this, to believe literally in reincarnation. That is to say, the idea that you have an individual enduring center or soul which is born into existence time after time after time. Zen people are divided as to whether they think that is so or not. I've met masters who believe that, and I've met masters who don't believe it at all. What they mean by the continual reappearance of individuality and consciousness out of the base is simply that what we see human beings and all forms of life coming and going. We don't see any continuity between them, but that is only because we don't see space. It is the interval between people, the space between lives, that constitutes the bond between them. This is very important. This is the whole philosophy of space. Now, I'm coming back to that in a minute. But the point is that through realizing this, those Zen monks had enormous nerve. And they could look a samurai in the face and said, okay, cut my head off, what does it prove? And the samurai were bugged by this. So they regarded those monks as sort of magical people and said, you teach us this, because if we learn this, we can really clobber the enemy. And so, Zen is like a spring coming out of the mountain. It doesn't flow out in order to feed a thirst, to quench the thirst of a traveler. But if the traveler wants to help himself to it, okay. It's up to you what you do with the water. The spring's job is just to flow. So Zen masters will teach anyone who has the tenacity to go after it, whoever he is. But the samurai were grateful, and so they let the Zen monks occupy the best land in town. And so in that land they built buildings that are essentially great heavy roofs in the Tang Dynasty Chinese style, supported by a kind of flimsiness underneath. They're like lanterns, all these buildings. Under the roof empty floors covered with straw mats and sliding screens and occasional cushions to sit on, nothing else. You get this feeling of living space. Well, now, what about that? I said that we disregard space. We think, you see, we know space is, so on the planet here, is full of air. And so that is something. Air occupies space, and that's more or less important. But we think of air as filling simply a void. And when astronomers start to talk about curved space or properties of space, the average person feels that his common sense has been offended. How could space be curved? How could it have any property? Because it isn't there, it's nothing. But the folly of thinking that way becomes apparent the moment you realize that solidness, materiality, density, is inconceivable apart from space. Space is the interval between solids, and thus, in some sense, the relationship between solids. Consider for a moment another kind of space altogether. We'll call it musical space, the interval between notes in a melody. Now, you play a sequence of notes. There is no pause, there is no silence between one note and another. They follow each other immediately. But it is only because of something that is not stated. The interval, in other words, is not sounded, but it is precisely because of the interval that you hear a melody. And if you don't hear an interval, as with a tone-deaf person, you hear no melody. You just hear a succession of noises. So, it is the space between the notes, the musical space, the step, the interval, that is really the essential element in melody. So in exactly the same way, it is space, interstellar space, which goes hand in hand with there being any stars or solids. It isn't just nothing. It is the other pole of something. Now, let's look at it from another point of view. I've looked at it astronomically and musically. Let's look at it for a moment aesthetically. When you see, for example, in a motel room, for some reason or other, hotels and motels love flower or bird prints in frames over the bed. And the typical Western flower print is a bunch of flowers set bang in the middle of a piece of paper. And this shows that the person who designed the print has no conception of space, because the space in that print serves merely as background. And it's nothing else. It has no function whatsoever. The space is not part of the picture. But when a Chinese painter uses space, you will see that if he paints a spray of grass or bamboos or a pine tree, he never sets it bang in the middle of the paper. He balances it off to one side so that what he has painted is, as we say, balanced by the space. And by this, he makes the space part of the painting. So by putting the spray of bamboo at one side immediately you see the part of the painting not touched as mist or water. He doesn't have to do a thing to it. Somehow it is all in the picture, and the bamboo is not merely against the background. Everything right out to the edge of the piece of paper has been included by doing this. Because he sees the polarity of space and solid. And he uses this polarity in the painting by balancing them against each other. But you do not notice that balance if the solid area, the painted thing, is put smack in the middle of the space. You abolish the importance of the space. It has no place in the painting. And so when we think of a solid, say a star, the sun, as simply sitting in the middle, we, by doing this, ignore space. I've had great fun with talking to college communities by doing experiments in gestalt psychology with them, figure and ground. And because you see, the gestalt theory of perception is that we tend to notice the figure and ignore the background. We tend to notice a moving object and ignore what is relatively still. We tend to notice areas that are tightly enclosed rather than those which are diffused. So if you draw a circle on the blackboard and say to the group, "What have I drawn?" They will invariably say a circle, a ball, a ring, or something like that. And I would say then, well, why has nobody suggested that I have drawn a wall with a hole in it? And that shows, you see, we ignore the background and pay attention to the figure. Now, painters, especially those Western painters who work with oil, they have to paint the background, you see. And so space becomes important. Architects will often talk about the properties of a space, because they know that what they're doing is they're making living space for people. They are enclosing spaces. And so space has a certain reality to the architect. But to the ordinary person, you see, space just isn't there. It's very interesting. You can practice this. I'm not going to try these experiments today because we're not sort of in the proper circumstances, but in meditation experiments, you can experience various kinds of space: optical space, auditory space, tactile space. You can realize by closing your eyes for a while what a blind man's conception of space would be. Every sense has its own appreciation of space. And there was a time in our own history, indeed, by reading between the lines of, say, ancient literature, it's as clear as late as Dante, that they regarded space and mind as the same thing. And if you think about that, you can see it is rather obvious. Take the mind of the eye, that's to say what Buddhists would call the vijnana here, that corresponds to seeing. The basis of sight is a sort of screen, isn't it? Just as you have a screen on which to project a color slide or a movie, there is a kind of ground, an area, in which everything that is seen must be. You have what we call the field of vision, which is a fuzzy oval. You see an oval area, in other words. This is the field of vision. So there has to be that open field for there to be any vision at all. It is the background. There was once an Englishman and an Indian Hindu sitting in a garden together. And the Hindu was trying to explain basic Indian philosophy to the Englishman. And so he said, look now, there is a hedge at the end of the garden. Against what do you see the hedge? And he said, against the hills. And what do you see the hills against? He said, against the sky. And what do you see a sky against? And the Englishman didn't know what to say. Until the Hindu said, well, you see it against consciousness. So, in the same way, you might say that auditory space is not exactly silence. What is auditory space? Auditory space is the eardrum, is a kind of vibrating skin, you see? So in the same way, the space for being itself, for material vibration, is the space which we think of as existing between the heavenly bodies. That is the ground, the field, in which quanta, electrical forces, must have in order to play. So then in the same way that space itself is invisible, consciousness is unknown, is not an object of knowledge. So in exactly the same way, this dimension of your being here is like space. That's why this basis is called amala vijnana, which means without taint. You can't make a mark on space. I was quoting the Buddha saying, the path of the enlightened ones leaves no track. It is like the path of birds in the sky. And so then, in Chinese, one wants to indicate the Buddhist idea of shunyata, or the ultimate reality of the world, as it's called the void, the Chinese use this character. Which means also sky and space. So the basic doctrine of the of Buddhist Mahayana philosophy is this. Here are the contrasting words. This is space. This is form. Shape. It also means color. And this combination here means exactly is, something like that. Space exactly is, or is precisely, the same as form. And you can reverse it by changing these two characters around, as the Heart Sutra does, and it says form is precisely emptiness. This is not quite the same as the English or European is, Latin est. It means rather is inseparable from, always goes with, the two are interdependent. You can't have space without form. You can't have form without space. So they are relational. And in that sense, they are each other. Because underneath every inseparable relation is something in common. So, to perceive this, to perceive that form reveals the void, and to see that the void reveals form, is the secret for the overcoming of death. To the extent that one is unaware of space, one is unaware of one's own eternity. It's the same thing. But people sometimes imagine that to be aware of the eternal dimension, the forms must disappear. The Vedanta people here teach this, that in Nirvikalpa Samadhi, which is the highest state of consciousness, the Samadhi means the meditation state, the concentration, the absorption. Nirvikalpa, meaning without, vikalpa literally means a concept. But they take it to mean without content. And we'll say that in the state of Nirvikalpa, one is completely devoid, the mind is completely devoid of any form or motion whatsoever. And that sounds like total blank. But in Zen, it would be said that a person whose mind is in that state is a stone Buddha. Because there the Buddha made of stone sitting on the altar has no consciousness. So if that's the ideal, okay, the stone Buddha has it. A piece of wood has it. There's no point in that. So they interpret all this in a very different way indeed. To have Nirvikalpa Samadhi, the highest state of consciousness, is not to have consciousness in which there are no forms. It is simply to reawaken to the reality of space and to see that forms come and go in space as the leaves come and go on the trees, as the stars come and go in the sky. But the sky is in a way the mother of the stars. Of course, no woman is a mother until she has a child. And in this sense, space does not come into being as the matrix of the world until there's something there. That's why the Chinese use this expression, they use this term to indicate the relationship between all opposites. To come into being, to arise mutually. That designates this situation. So these two things, space and form, arise mutually, as do being and non-being. So then you see, you can say in practical life, to the degree that you are unaware of space, to the same degree you are unaware of the fullness of your nature. And I suppose as our population increases and we get more crowded and space will become more valuable, this will help us to be more aware of it. Perhaps that is the reason why species multiply. Because as manyness increases, the consciousness of oneness increases. So in Zen, the Zen is a philosophy where you can say, in answer to the question, what is the ultimate reality? The master says 3 pounds of flax. He chooses something very particular, something extremely concrete, something very everyday, something indeed quite worldly, to answer this metaphysical question. Why? Because space does not obliterate the particular, But rather, it is precisely the particular, the individual thing, the ordinary everyday event, which proclaims and advertises the underlying unity of the world. The many advertise the one, just as the solid implies, and indeed exhibits and brings out the fact that there is space. Were there no solids, there would be no space. You see, if you try to imagine space with no solid, you have to get rid of yourself looking at it, because you're a solid in the middle of the space. So space, space, space forever, with nothing in it, is an absolutely meaningless, unimaginable concept. You have to have space and solid. They always go together. So then, this explains the enormous, the many, many ways in which Zen life has feeling for space. Their idea of poverty, for example, the poverty of the monk, is not poverty as we have thought of it in the Western tradition. It isn't that poverty is a sort of oppression. The poor are deprived, and they feel denuded by poverty. Poverty is simply an absence, it's a pain. In Zen, voluntary poverty is considered not really as poverty so much as simplicity. Freedom, uncluttedness. And they have the same meaning for purity. When the pure mind, this again, taintless, purity means not that you are a prude. They don't think of purity in that sense at all. Doesn't mean not having any appetites, not feeling hungry, never feeling sexy or anything like that. Purity means clarity. A pure eye is a clear eye without sort of dust on it. A pure mirror is a mirror without dust. But the real prototype of purity in Buddhistic literature is not so much the mirror as space itself. That is purity. It is clarity. It is transparency. It is also freedom. And this is a peculiarly noticeable thing about the personality of Zen people, is the uncluttered mind. When you deal with a Zen master, you have the strange feeling that so long as you are related to him and addressing him, he is absolutely with you. He has nothing else to do but to talk to you. He's just right there like that. But he's willing also, Zen masters do have some small talk. They're not like those terribly serious spiritual people who have no small talk at all and who can't just pass the time of day. They're not like that. But on the other hand, they don't waste time. They're never distracted. They don't dither around. And so when something is finished, it's finished. They go right on to the next thing. And you can see this in the way they walk. They have a characteristic walk, which is quite different from other Japanese people's walk. This may be partly due to dress, because the Japanese kimono, in a way, and especially the sandals that are worn, cause people to shuffle. And most people shuffle down the street. Zen monks have a wider skirt on the robe, and they stride. And they stride with a kind of a rhythm that is completely characteristic. You know, when you see a cat crossing the road, The cat always looks as if it knows where it's going. There's something about a cat that is, it goes across the road. And a Zen monk walking down the street is exactly like a cat crossing a road. There's the same feeling of freedom. I remember one morning, I was staying in an inn on the edge of Nanzenji, which is on the northeast corner of Kyoto. And I was, as I usually do, I get up very early and sit on the balcony. And I heard in the distance this sound. Ho, 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 ho. It came nearer and nearer, and I saw these monks with their big mushroom hats on and their begging bowls out in front like this. Ho means the Dharma. And they were coming with this boom, 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 swinging walk down the street. Well, I thought I'll put something in the bowl, you know, and I shot downstairs. But by the time I got downstairs, they'd gone. So we had dinner in the monastery that night. And I said to the priest who was entertaining us, I told him this incident, and I said, you know, I don't think your monks are serious about begging. Because in the early morning, the little cart comes with groceries. And the little cart stays around long enough for the housewives to come out and buy the vegetables. At night there comes a man who sells ramen, which is noodle soup, on a little cart. And he stays around long enough for people to come out. But your monks don't stay around long enough for anybody to give them anything. I don't think they're really begging at all. They're just fat and rich, and they're begging as a gesture. Next morning,
I... Did he answer you before that?
What?
Did he answer
that? No, he didn't say anything. It laughed, you know. Next morning, I went down, and I stood on the lower level. And the monks came by, but they weren't begging. They carry the big mushroom hat in their hands, in front of them like this, pointing outwards, when they're not begging, they're just walking. And the lead monk, there were about three of them, walking single file, Indian file, and he looked at me and bowed with a kind of evil grin. I don't know whether the priest told them, but... But it is so interesting the way they've got this free walk. It looks, you have a sense, Suzuki put it this way. A Zen monk is a concentration of energy which is available immediately for anything. This is likened in one of the master's writings that when you have water in a vessel, and you make a hole, the water is immediately available to come out. It doesn't stop to think, it immediately comes out. So also when you clap your hands, the sound is the clapping of the hands, it comes out at once, it doesn't stop to think. When you strike a stone with steel, the sparks are there immediately. So in the same way, there is this always availability, always readiness to act. And therefore, they live a life which is empty, spacious, in the sense of being unblocked. In the way that we use the word blocking in psychology, when we say you're blocking to somebody who's got a hang-up and they can't get round it. You're blocking. So to get rid of blocks is to have space in one's life. It's the same old space we've been talking about all along. So then the heart doctrine of Buddhism, the final feeling about the universe at the end of the line when you really get down to it, is called in Japanese Jiji Muge, or in Chinese Shur Shur Wu Ai. Between all things and events in the universe, mu ge, there is no block. In other words, everything in the universe, every event that ever happens, implies all the others. And the connection between them is space, which is no block.
So let's have an intermission.